Session number 10112, reel 7.
Mr. Thompson, reel 7.
Well, you'd say to the other, look here, chum, I know all about you. I can put you into jail. I can put you away for a long time. Now, unless you play ball with me, and in a sense you are blackmailing him. But I think almost on reel 1 of this recording, I said to you, there's something about it, Kikuyu, that if he decides to dislike you, he dislikes you a lot, but if he decides to trust you, he will trust you. This is one of the great things about the Kikuyu, and I had the most enjoyable, despite all this horror of Mau Mau, the most wonderful period of my life was with them. And later on, when I was serving in the West Indies, I often used to say, oh, I wish I got a gang of Kikuyu with me. I wish I had my Kikuyu staff with me. We could really run this place. So you could strike a bargain with them, as it were, which is a form of blackmail, I know, but you could find out who your friends were. Eventually you did. Those who had stood up against all sorts of evils, those whose families had been chopped around them. I mean, I had one man who lost his wife, his mother, his father, all his children. That man is not going to let you down. He's got some scores to settle. So you start building up this group of people whom you can trust. And then they provide information. And so it becomes possible to swing this mystic 2%. But they are there. Even if you can't positively identify them as individuals. What is it? What we in England call the floating vote?
So, when you said right at the beginning that you said, I think, 90% were with Mau Mau, what you really meant was it was the 90% who seemed to think that things were going the Mau Mau's way, so they were the sheep and goats who followed them.
Well, one mustn't equate the chief's 94% with an odd 6 floating with that figure precisely, because there are other reasons come into this. It was clear to us that, in broad terms, 90% had oathed. 90% were Mau Mau. It is convenient to say that 8 to 10% were not. But you then have to try and analyse why within that 8 to 10% they were not. Some is because they were recoiling against the tax made, some because they were plainly bloody-minded people. Now, one thing about the Kikuyu is you can't push a Kikuyu around too much. He's very much like us there. He won't be pushed. He can be very, very stubborn. There were some who just weren't going to be pushed. Some who said, well, Kenyatta isn't really a true Kikuyu. He's got some Embu blood in him. I don't trust the Embu. That'd be a very small number. But this sort of talk went on. Then would be those who, by virtue of their Christian belief, said this is wrong. So that figure of 10% against doesn't precisely match up the chief's illustration. But the chief's illustration is a very good way of illustrating how it works.
But presumably, just because you'd taken an oath, it didn't mean to say that you were Mau Mau, did it?
In most cases, it did. It was this small number of people who had been forced to take the oath, who didn't like it, who really gave us our first information. But that wasn't necessarily because they were... Well, you see, it is this grey area, which I've referred to before, of some who are for, some who are against, for various reasons. I'm sorry, I've got to be dreadfully vague here. I can't quite answer your question, to be honest.
Can we say something more about the other tribes and what view they took of Mau Mau? Was it something they feared, were apprehensive about, or indifferent to, or what?
I think here you have to understand tribalism a little bit. Tribes are self-contained entities, particularly in those days. They spoke vastly different languages. And people who belonged to the Nilotic group of tribes, the Abaluhya, the Jaluo, had no language in common. They were physically different. They had no customs in common. They lived hundreds of miles apart. The Maasai would sneer at a Kikuyu, saying that they'd always beaten up the Kikuyu in the past and raided them, and the Kikuyu had never fought back, which incidentally is a lie. The Kikuyu are far more clever than the Maasai. But the Maasai despise them. The Wakamba, just down the road, who have an allied group of the Bantu, very similar to the Kikuyu, they had been fighting with the Kikuyu for as long as history could remember. They hated each other in a war, they were always at war. They had no liking for each other. And so they didn't get enmeshed in Kikuyu politics. And the Kikuyu weren't appealing to them. This is why I start off by saying this was not a nationalist thing. This was an internal Kikuyu thing, which blossomed out later on or was manipulated later on. So the other tribes, if anything, despised the Kikuyu. They also disliked them because they knew in their heart of hearts that the Kikuyu were the most clever of the tribes. There wasn't a district in Kenya where you wouldn't find a clerk was more likely to be a Kikuyu than anyone else. The Kikuyu were in all the sort of clerkly positions. Kikuyu somehow got into trade. Whilst the Maasai were being haughty, standing on their spears, and see what they've been downgraded to today, appearing on television, leaning on their spears. The Kikuyu were going about their business. The Kikuyu were beginning to run. It was the Kikuyu who ran the first shops, the first native-run businesses. The Kikuyu were a clever tribe, and the other tribes were very suspicious of them. The Nandi, or known, of course, for their great running prowess, they loathed the Kikuyu. They despised them. They looked down on them as silly little forest men. The fact that they were wily forest men and were very clever was beside the point. So, in fact, we were able to recruit other tribes into the forces, into the police, which allowed us to use them against the Kikuyu. In fact, there was a policy of not recruiting more than an absolute minimum number of Kikuyu into the armed forces and the police.
Could you tell me on record how you captured the war diary? Because you told me off the record earlier on.
Yes. It was sometime in 1953, I think. Yes, it must have been. 54. One evening, by this time, the gangs were operating on a big scale up and down the river valleys, coming out at night, and we had flushed out small gangs all around my headquarters. And my headquarters area was regarded as reasonably safe. We used to have floodlights on at night and guards, and every so often shots were fired towards us, but nothing to worry about. And one evening, it was a lovely evening. Oh, first of all, let me describe the topography. My station was on top of a hill at Kandara. There was another hill, half a mile away, is the direct line, and a deep, deep valley between the two. On top of the other hill was a Kikuyu independent school, which had long been closed down, because we closed the independent schools down as centres of subversion. But it had a rather nice garden with some roses in it, and I was feeling like an evening stroll, and I was just going down the pass down the valley, and my Sergeant Major of Tribal Police, one Sergeant Major Andrea Muturia, asked me where I was going, and I said, I was walking across to the school, and he said, no, Bonnie, you can't do that, it's dangerous. I suppose I said something on the lines of, well, it's not. Well, the outcome of that was that he strolled across with me. We carried no arms. In fact, I made a point of not carrying arms. This comes back to not wanting to be seen as a paramilitary. And he was unarmed. We're going up towards the school, and I'm just about to pick the roses. I think I got some comic opera idea of trying to strike them and root them. And he noticed that a window, a boarded-up window, was open. And he said, Wana, that window's open. It shouldn't be open. Be careful. And he crept up to the window and motioned me up, and there were some people inside talking. And so he was a very big man, was Andrea. He jumped at the door, which was next to the window, bashed it open, and we dived in. And Andrea collared about three of these guys. I know a couple leapt out to the window, and I think, as I said to you earlier, I persuaded myself I'd captured one. I think I merely held on to one that Andrea knocked down. And the outcome of this was that we made three arrests, and we got a rifle, a pistol, a 3.8, I think it was, and a hand grenade. But also, on the table, there had obviously been a committee of some kind in session. There were papers and books on the table. And we held these people. I remember Andrea blew his whistle, and the Kikuyu area at 5,500 feet is very clear in the evening air, and whistles and shouting brought people over eventually. And I got hold of these papers and took them back to my office. And got my interpreter work on interpretation. They were written partly in English, bad English, and partly in Kikuyu. And I got him on the Kikuyu bits. And I kept to this day, this is not a full version. I think I've lost some pages. But I have here about six, seven pages, of what turned out to be part of their war history, their war diary. It's quite interesting. I even get a mention in it, actually.
Were they people known to you?
I don't think so. I don't remember that they were.
You talked earlier on about the different attitude which administrators like yourself had in Kenya politically towards that the settlers had. Did this ever lead, in your personal experience, to friction with the settlers?
I was very friendly in Kikuyu land with the settlers on my border, and two or three of them I used to visit quite regularly. I'd go and take a drink off them. I remember I spent a Christmas day with one of them in the middle of it all. We did have differences. There was one man and his wife who were very anti the administration. They were of the old school, thought we were being weak, whatever that may have meant. And I remember going to see this old boy and saying, he lived on a coffee estate about 3 miles over my border into the Thika district. And I remember saying to him, now look here, sir, I have positive information from my deoding and on my cards that your cook is a leading Mau Mau oather in this area. And I've come to tell you this. And that all your staff have been oathed and they're all Mau Mau. And you have got guns in your house. You must either get rid of them, because you're safer without guns and being raided for guns, or you must get rid of your staff. You've got to do something about it. And he gave me such a tongue-lashing. God, you people don't know, you upstarts, you come out here. I've been here ever since 1910. I know my staff. My old cook wouldn't do anything like this. Well, the short story is that within a few weeks after that, he and his wife were chopped to death and their guns stolen. There were a considerable number of people like that. I think a lot of it was probably a reaction to fear, you know. They're beginning to realise that this life they'd built up for themselves in Kenya, and it had been a hard life, times had been bad, and over the years, especially between the wars, there'd been no prices for coffee or any of the crops. They'd had a hard time. I think it was because they felt they deserved better. And they didn't understand what we were trying to do. Moving on to when I went up to Nyanza province, I was posted there. Now, I've now moved out of the Mau Mau area completely, the emergency area, and I'm in a district which has been progressing normally, and which had got an African District Council, which was run, all African run. It had an annual budget of well over £250,000, which in those days was a lot of money. It ran all the roads, bridges, all sorts of things that a district council does. And I remember we decided to invite, we bounded onto another settled area, what was known as the Washingishu or the Trans Nzoia, up in the northern part of Kenya. And we invited a group of farmers there to come over for a day to see what we were doing and to see how our district council worked. And I remember one saying to me, if you think I'm going to waste my time coming to see that bloody nonsense. Well, he wasn't typical, and the others came, and they were absolutely amazed. They'd never looked across the border. They'd only seen the area as a reservoir for their labour. They hadn't a clue what we were doing. They hadn't a clue that we maintained our own roads with our own equipment, built our own bridges, built our own houses, taxed ourselves. They couldn't understand it. And their reaction to this was, what are you doing? What are you doing? This is frightening. You're pushing these people on too much. Where are we going to stand?
They thought you were undermining them.
I think so, yes. Now, it's easy to generalise. I mean, there were plenty of settlers in Kenya who knew precisely what was going on, were well ginned up and were intelligent people, and many of them are there today. They didn't all move out by any means. But you have to look at the white settler tribe as a whole. And they didn't know, probably because they didn't want to know. You don't want to know. The analogy of Britain, it keeps coming back to me. The number, and I'm not expressing any personal political view here. I'm using it as an example. You think of the number of good, sound, elderly conservatives who quake in their shoes at the thought that the Labour Party might get in and what Mr. Benn would do. It's the same attitude.
Talking about the military side of it, you were talking about the very big clashes that occurred in 52-53 period. You actually quoted one in which there were a large number of casualties. Did you ever feel at any stage that, militarily speaking, Britain could have been driven out of the country?
No, it wasn't that kind. It wasn't that kind of war. Oh no. It wasn't a question of the Africans banding together and driving us out. There was no centralised military organisation such as the Americans had to face up to with the Viet Cong. Oh no, nothing like that at all.
Do you think the Mau Mau thought they could have done that?
No. That was never their aim.
You mentioned that you had something to do with sorting out the Hola situation.
Yes.
Could you say what you had to do with that?
Well, that it really is a story of itself. May I pursue it on those lines?
Yes.
After my time in Nyanza province, I was posted down to the coast province. And if I can just refer you to the coast of Kenya, north of Mombasa, 300 miles north, the Tana River enters the sea. And that Tana River, if tracked back, takes you right back into Kikuyu land on Mount Kenya. And I was with the... I was stationed at the mouth of the river. I became district commissioner of the Tana River district, which embrace land on both sides of the river, about 7,000, 8,000 square miles of it. It was largely empty. The Pakomo tribe lived along the river. The Gulla and the Orma were nomads in the drier parts of the district way off the river. And because it was so lonely and far from anywhere, the government had sited one of the detention camps there, on the basis that if it was miles from anywhere, it would be hard to escape from. Now, by the time I go down to Tana River, the state of emergency is still in force, and there were several thousand Kikuyu still the subject of detention orders, and there's three of these camps, the largest of which was at a place called Manyani, the second largest was at Hola, and it was at Hola that some really hardcore Mau Mau people were kept. Now, although It was blessed with the name of Hola, which was the name of one of the riverine villages. It wasn't actually at Hola, it was some distance inland there. And under emergency legislation, it had virtually been excised from the district, so that I, as the district commissioner, had no responsibility for it whatsoever. My only role in connection with that camp was as chief magistrate of the district. I could be visiting magistrate to the prison part of it. It was two parts. One part of this camp was for detainees, the other was a prison for ordinary criminals. And I had visiting rights, as any magistrate would, to the prison to inspect. And occasionally, when I was on safari upriver, and it was a long, long 240 miles upriver, most of which was done by boat, I didn't get there very often. I said it was a place where very hot, hardcore and vicious Mau Mau were kept, and they were under the control of the prisons department. This is important to understand. And it was also a base for a large scale project to see what could be irrigated from the Tana River, and these detainees were largely, those who were employable or would consent to work, were being used on the irrigated land, which was under the management of a man who'd been brought in from the great cotton growing Gezira scheme in the Sudan. Well, one day in, that would this be, now when would this be, I'll come back to that. One day I was upriver on safari. I camped overnight on the river banks, and I was sitting under the shade of a big fever tree, hearing the Pacomo, were the local tribe there. I was hearing a Pacomo land case. Now, I want to tell you just a little bit about this case, because it's going to provide a bit of the flavour of the background. The river flooded. Although it was a very dry area, the floods used to come down from the highlands, the Kikuyu Highlands, during the wet season, and bring with it not only a great spate of water, but lots of mud and slush as well. And there had been a particularly heavy flood, which had carved away a bit of land from a man's farm. It had deposited this mud, so the Pacomo said, on the other side of the river, which had enlarged another man's farm. So I'm sitting, as it were, hearing a most interesting argument as to whether A's land can be taken by God by means of the river, deposited across on a half a mile downstream on the other side, become another man's land. The sort of thing which would exercise African minds considerably. As I say, it was a nice morning, I was sitting under the tree. I'm listening to this, and suddenly a white prisons officer appeared in a Land Rover in a great flurry of dust, rushed up to me and didn't salute. This annoyed the locals. Very polite. He should have saluted the Bwana, it's our district commissioner. And they tut-tutted, and this chap said to me, could you come, please, to the camp, because there's been a death. And I said, well, I'm sorry, I'm very busy. What's the death about? He said, oh, just a death. I said, well, no, I can't. I'm in the middle of a case here, and I must hear this case and finish it. But I'll come as soon as I can. And away he went, and a bit later, down came another Land Rover and another person who said, could I come back again? Would I go soon? Because there were two deaths now. We thought there might be something wrong. Well, I said I would hurry up my case and be there as soon as I could. But then, within 10 minutes, a senior prison commandant arrived and said, you must come, there are 7 dead. So I abandoned the case. I often wonder whether I ever went back and finished it. And I went into the camp where I saw a group of people, prison officers, black and white, surrounding what appeared to be a large number of people who were either sitting up holding their hands or lying flat on the ground. And I could see almost at once that many of these were dead. And at that time, I think the count was 9. Very shortly went up to 11. I asked what had happened, and I was told that these people had refused to work the heat, that they'd been taken out to work, they'd been overcome by the heat, and they'd thrown buckets of water over them, and it appeared that some of them had drowned, perhaps. Well, it so happened that there was a young medical officer, straight out from England, who had just been posted to this dreadful spot, and it really was a dreadful spot. Why the medical department was so insensitive as to send a young, totally inexperienced doctor there in the first place, and why they should give a young chap straight out such a hell place to go to, I don't know. He was totally confused, and I said to him, "Doctor, do you think, is it true that these people have died? I can see lots of water around, I can see a watered cart." And he said, "Well, it is possible." Well, I started to look at the bodies, and it was apparent to me at once that these had been beaten. They hadn't drowned. It was also apparent to me, which no one else seemed to have latched on to, that this was a political crisis, that when this news broke, all hell was going to be let loose. So I said to the prison officers, the senior prison officer, "Now, whatever happens, you must not get onto the..." They were looking at me, who had no authority there, to tell them what to do. So I decided I was district commissioner, and I sort of donned my district commissioner's hat and become very district commissionerish, and I said, "Whatever happens, you are not to speak to your department on your radio," because I knew that the prison's radio was on a wavelength which could be tuned into on any domestic set, and which the East African Standard, our local newspaper, kept tuned to. So I said, "Whatever you do, don't get the news on that. I'll get through on the police radio," which was VHF, I think. "And let me pass the messages to Nairobi. Now, don't you pass any messages." And this was agreed to. And I went to the police radio, which wasn't very far away, a tiny little police station, about three constables there. And I called Nairobi, and I got straight through to police headquarters, and I demanded to speak to the commissioner. And within no time at all, it was all very quick, a voice came on and said the commissioner was out in a meeting, but this was the assistant commissioner crime. And luckily for me, I knew him. We'd met up in the past, and I knew him by his Christian name. And I said it was me, Tommy, because I'd known universities, Tommy Thompson, I was. And I said, "Something has happened here, which I'm not going to tell you over this radio. All I can tell you is that it's very, very serious, and you must get down here with a senior CID man, if possible your commissioner. Fly in. You've got Keeney Police Air Wing aircraft. Fly in this afternoon." I said, "I want you to bring a representative from my own ministry and a representative from the prisons. Will you pass a message to the prisons to come and to keep this radio silence?" I was thinking politically. Well, a message comes from my own ministry that they're very sorry the minister's at lunch. He was an old ex-provincial commissioner of mine. The permanent secretary was at lunch, but they would try and send someone probably tomorrow, which didn't please me very much. The prisons, despite my plea not to use their set, immediately got on their open set and demanded of their man that he tell them what's going on. And the cover's blown. I wanted time. I wasn't trying to obscure a happening. I knew it was too great for that. What I wanted was time to get things moving. Well, anyway, the Kenya police did their stuff beautifully. And they sent in the most senior people. They were there within this flying time, virtually. They moved. And they agreed with me. They saw the bodies that beatings up had taken place.